I'd like to point out that the case of Buckley versus Vallejo, which has assured me immortality of sorts, only got it half right. We still have limits on what you can give to a particular candidate. But in any event, thank you for having me here. American conservatism provides a sure basis for effective public policy because it is based not on any assumption as to how the world ought to work, but on knowledge accumulated over the years on how it actually does work. It provides a reliable guide to public policy because it is based on the one constant in human affairs, human nature itself. James Madison studied the failed experiments in political freedom all the way back to ancient Greece, and he identified the human thirst for power as the root cause of all their failures. Hence the precautions against the expansion of federal authority that the framers wrote into the Constitution, the separation of powers and the principle of federalism, precautions that unfortunately have been largely undermined by the Supreme Court. The same is true of the economic insights of Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. There is nothing intuitive about the discovery of the invisible hand that translates the search for profits in a free competitive marketplace into a mechanism that assures consumers of the widest range of products at the lowest feasible prices. Smith's insights were based on a most careful study of economic causes and effects of human reactions to a variety of incentives, and they are as valid today as they were when he identified them. The problem conservatives face in today's fractured intellectual marketplace is that while liberal policies lend themselves to the seductive sound bites, ours have to be explained and explained persuasively to a distracted public. In addressing the myriad issues of the day, we must not only demonstrate the merits of our positions, but in the process make the underlying principles that guide us so explicit and persuasive that they become embedded in the public mind. Of the many challenges we face today, I believe the crucial one is to achieve a major reduction in the nature and scope of federal responsibilities. This will be an incredibly difficult task, but in my view, that is essential if we are to avert slipping irretrievably into the suffocating embrace of an all-caring state and all that that implies for the erosion of individual freedoms. Too few people appreciate the degree and the speed with which we are converting ourselves into a full-service state. When I was in the Senate, the United States Code consisted of 11 volumes of statutes. Today, there are 34 of them, and they in turn are supplemented by 235 volumes of fine print regulations that have the force of law and reach into every corner of our lives. This dramatic expansion of the federal authority has undermined Congress's ability to operate effectively. Whereas an administrative agency consists of specialists who can focus on a discrete area of responsibility, legislators are supposed to bring an informed judgment to bear on every bill that comes before them for a vote. Today, that is impossible, and it has been impossible for decades. Shortly after my election to the Senate in 1970, someone handed me a recent study of Congress that had concluded that the workload of the average congressional office had doubled every 5 years since 1935. As Congress once worked at a leisurely pace and was in session 5 or 6 months a year, its members could take the earlier increases in stride simply by working more hours a day and extending the length of congressional sessions. By the time I arrived in Washington, those extra hours and months had been exhausted, and life in Congress had long since been turned into a treadmill. By every report, the situation is infinitely worse today. There is no meaningful floor debate, no time for study and reflection. Staffs and special interests patch together 1,000-page bills that no one has the time to read. Because thoughtful legislation requires attention to detail that members no longer have time to devote, a responsibility for more and more of the essential legislative provisions are delegated to agencies which then spill out the implementing regulations. As a result, too often today, Congress has little understanding of how much its latest mega bill it will cost or how it will operate in the real world. And today, those agencies administer so vast a number of programs that effective congressional oversight is virtually impossible. That, I believe, is at the root of what we have in Washington today, a legislature that can no longer legislate responsibly, an administrative establishment that too often exceeds its authority, and an executive that, out of frustration or imperial impulse, increasingly feels free to rule by edict. That is why I believe our most urgent task is to find ways to reduce the scope of federal responsibilities to a size that will allow Congress to once again serve as an effective deliberative body, one that is capable of enacting laws it understands and delegating administrative responsibilities it can oversee. If we can't accomplish that, I fear that the other victories we may achieve from time to time will prove no more than fingers in the dike that provide only temporary relief from the glacial advance of the administrative state. As I explain in my book, Saving Congress from Itself, I believe the most effective approach to that goal is to seek at the outset the elimination of a whole category of federal legislation that is particularly vulnerable to attack and on objective analysis equally difficult to defend. I refer to the grants and aid programs that offer subsidies to states and their subdivisions for a vast range of state and local activities. Congress finds the authority to enact those programs in a 1937 Supreme Court holding, which, as summarized in the court's recent Obamacare case, authorizes Congress to use federal funds to, quote, induce the states to adopt policies that the federal government itself could not impose. To put it another way, Congress is licensed to dabble in the areas in which it is forbidden to act, which it does by bribing the states to adopt Washington's approaches to problems that are the state's sole responsibility. Those programs have proven so attractive a form of pork that its number has increased from 132 at the outset of the Lyndon Johnson administration to over 1,100 today. In 1970, they distributed $24 billion. This year, they will distribute almost $641 billion, or one out of every $6 of federal spending. Yet objective studies of a 50-year record demonstrate that they waste vast amount of money by creating unnecessary layers of administration, imposing yards of rigid regulations on how the money is to be spent, and triggering hundreds of thousands of unfunded mandates. Studies also confirm that the program's creation and exploitation now occupy major portions of congressional time. To curry a favor with constituents, members involve themselves in a whole range of issues that are the business of governors and city councils instead of attending to the critical and controversial issues that only Congress can address. The program's most serious cost, however, is in their distortion of the way we govern ourselves. Thanks to the rigid regulations that come with federal grants, they too often convert states' elected officials into mere administrators of programs made in Washington. Because the grants impose one-size-fits-all regulations on states as different as Hawaii and New York, they prevent state officials from applying common sense and local knowledge in securing the best value for the money spent. And because offers of 60 or 80% federal financing are politically irresistible, they distort state priorities in major ways. Most significantly, the grants undermine accountability because state officials bound by federal regulations can't be held responsible for the costs and failures of the programs they manage. And because those regulations are made by distant bureaucrats, frustrated citizens who are affected by those projects have lost their ability to decide how their tax dollars will be used. As The Economist magazine recently put it, public services can be nationally uniform or locally accountable. They cannot be both. The logical way to cure the situation is to abolish all of those programs. If Congress should do that, at a single stroke, it would balance the federal books, rid its members of a major distraction from their essential national responsibilities, and restore the ability of state and local voters to manage their own affairs. At the outset, most members of Congress will hate it. But once Americans have learned the true cost of those programs, they will know they have everything to gain from their termination, both as citizens and taxpayers. And as we have learned from time to time in the past, an engaged electorate can achieve political miracles. We will have ample opportunities to inform the public of those costs because new programs are constantly coming on stream. But in challenging them, it is essential that we go beyond the merits of the particular actions they propose to subsidize and hammer home the fact that they belong to a category of legislation that is inherently wasteful, inherently unworkable, and inherently subversive of the Constitution because they all result in the federal assumption of responsibilities that are properly and most effectively exercised by the states. If we make those points often and skillfully enough, we can create a public suspicion of all such programs and, in time, stigmatize those that are now on the books and speed their elimination. And that, I suggest, should be a major goal of an effective post-Reagan conservatism. Thank you.